back to the D-Fly and Dixie podcast inside lacrosse. Mark Dixon, my partner, can't make it this week. So happy to say that we are joined by Inside Lacrosse Editor-in-Chief Matt Kinnear. He'll be along to talk about news that happened this week, preview all of the games. We have a great interview with Jacksonville head coach John Galloway and a lot more. Matt Kinnear, let's get it.
I thought I was going to get to do the whip sound. This is disappointing.
Thanks for joining us. Yeah, Dixie has got a lot going on this week and wasn't able to find the time to record. So you jumped in. It's a team effort. I really appreciate it. And great to have you on board here.
Thanks for having me. Always love doing it. And apologies in advance to the listeners here. I hope I can – I don't know if I can fill Dixon's shoes. I'll do my best. But send all your hate to Dan if I don't.
It's all good. Hey, great weekend for lacrosse. We had six top 20 matchups. Lots of games were available. All the good games were. I mean, I watched, I think, parts of eight different games on Saturday. It was, you know, you'd flip on the BU game and they're playing in a snowstorm. I saw images of Albany driving to Cornell and their bus trip, how harrowing that experience was. And then you turn on the games that were in the South and they're playing on green fields and guys are in the stands are wearing shorts and t-shirts. And it's great February lacrosse. Great week for the Big Ten. They had some great wins. Bad week for the Patriot League. And also a great week for Inside Lacrosse. Congratulations on some record website traffic.
Yeah, we had our, you know, what we believe is our biggest traffic day ever on Saturday. And, you know, we have a pretty good idea of the flow of our website from week to week. So we're only going to break that in the coming weeks as we move forward. So thanks to all the readers. We've tried to take as much feedback as possible and incorporate it into what we're doing. And I'll be a little cryptic here, but we have another project that we're a few weeks away from launching that I think the readers of InsideLacrosse.com are going to be really excited about. Something they can play during the weekend while the games are going on, kind of a second screen experience. So really pumped about to bring that to you guys very soon. And thanks for clicking and reading everything and listening to everything that we do.
Now let's take a look at the past week, looking through the lens of the Inside Lacrosse Top 20. There were some big movers. The biggest one being the Ohio State Buckeyes after their incredible win. And it was no fluke. They played great and they beat a pretty good team. We saw North Carolina bounce back midweek with a game against Brown, which they won. Solid win there. What does this mean for the Big Ten? And you also count Hopkins' win and Rutgers' win over Army.
It's interesting. I think the narrative that was out there last year that the Big Ten was down always seemed a little bit silly to me. So I think at the very least, and maybe the most important thing is it just quiets that narrative that the Big Ten wasn't good last year for whatever reason. There were teams hovering or below 500 because they're playing each other. And that's just the thing. When you have good teams going against each other, they're going to beat each other. The way that it worked out is, you know, you had a Maryland team that was awesome and a Rutgers team that was just a step below them, and the rest of the teams just beat each other up. Doesn't necessarily mean they were bad. It just means they didn't have, you know, a cupcake to beat or a mid-major to beat up on in any other time of the season. So I think the biggest thing is just closing the door on that narrative that the Big Ten wasn't good last year, because I think it was bogus anyway. I'm sure we fed into it in some ways that if you look back, that probably were incorrect. But the Big Ten is up there with the ACC in terms of the elite in college lacrosse. They certainly proved it this weekend. And, you know, when you're looking at Ohio State, man, that is just like you said, it was no fluke. You could expect, you see some of those scores sometimes and you're like, okay, Ohio State beat North Carolina. It doesn't mean that Ohio State is that great. It doesn't mean North Carolina is that bad. And I don't think it means North Carolina is bad. I think it just means Ohio State is a lot better than we gave them credit for. To go out there and 10 different goal scorers for score the first 10 goals of a game, that's not something that a fluky team does. You need to have a tremendous amount of depth. There's just that, you know, I think Ohio State is one of those teams that Nick Myers, the way he runs his program, I think they feed off of just the togetherness of the program. something that was lost last year with COVID and a lot of protocols. And, you know, from what I remember in the months leading up to the season, they were one of the teams that was kind of most hit hard by COVID in terms of limiting their practice time and their ability to get stuff done together. I think you're seeing the benefit of kind of the brotherhood of Ohio State lacrosse, you know, being a fully formed thing this year.
Another school that had similar type of struggles, and that's fairly well publicized, is Hopkins Blue Jays and their inability to meet, especially with a new coaching staff coming in during a pandemic. That is their struggles and difficulties and challenges with the new staff. And again, it may sound a little biased being a double Hopkins graduate, but there is some type of level of trying to set an example because of their leadership in the medical community to be a little bit more cautious about everything on campus when it comes to health protocols. And, you know, it really separated the team and they got a huge win. One that honestly, as a fan, I was pleasantly surprised to see and wasn't sure that they were going to pull that game out against Loyola. And it's a big step for the Big Ten.
Yeah, Johns Hopkins, I think their defense kind of really showed up and showed that they could make some big plays, and not just big plays on the defensive end, but also, you know, as you saw at the end of the game there, some transition plays and making some big plays on the offensive end as well. You know, I'm still a little undecided about what I think of Johns Hopkins in terms of their long-term potential for this year. I think that they are better than people maybe gave them credit for. I think they are more like the Johns Hopkins we saw that was almost beating Maryland at the end of last season than the Johns Hopkins that we saw that was, you know, losing games they shouldn't lose early in last season. So I think you got to be pretty happy if you're Johns Hopkins, particularly with the defensive performance. You know, I think that for Loyola, maybe Loyola just has a lot more to work on than we think. Goalie is obviously a big question mark for them. And then their short stick, you know, defensive midfield unit, which, you know, if you know anything historical about Loyola, you know, in that span from them winning a national championship to now, their rope unit is always very good. So for that to not be a strength of this team is a little bit concerning if you're Charlie Toomey right now. So I don't know how you fix that. I don't know if you can fix that other than just try to work around it the best way that you possibly can. Their close defense at Loyola, I think, is pretty good, but they just their shorties are getting exposed left and right. And, you know, Johns Hopkins has offensive talent. I don't think it's the most talented offensive team, but I think that they have, you know, several really good players. Obviously we know what Epstein can do. You know, we know what a few of those guys are. I've liked Angelus a lot in these first few weeks. Again, I think he fits Pete Millman's mold of a little bit of a harder edge, is going to grind a little bit for you. But they were able to expose Loyola. I think their short sticks are just not that good right now. And some soul searching there if you're Charlie Toomey.
Matt, we have a ton of great games to get to. So let's start with some of the previews for this week. There are six top 20 matchups alone on Saturday and one on Sunday that we will cover. Let's jump right in. First game on Saturday is at noon, being played on Long Island at MacArthur High School. Number 10 Penn will take on the number 7 Duke Blue Devils.
This is a big one. I saw Penn in person this past week. You know, I think I've been someone who's been maybe higher on Penn than others heading into this season. I think they're a really talented squad, but, you know, there's the combination of Georgetown's defense being very, very good and Penn playing for the first time in 700 and some days, playing the first D1 competition in 700 and some days. I thought their offense left me wanting a little bit more in the sense that Sam Hanley should be a game-changing type player. I don't think he had his best game. I think he tried to do a little bit too much. They didn't share the ball as well as you'd think. I thought their defense was very good. And that's kind of what I'm looking forward to this weekend is, you know, Duke has so many offensive weapons. It's going to be a really good test for that Penn defense that I thought handled Georgetown as well as you possibly could in that game. You know, Georgetown only scoring 10 goals is, I'd say, a win for your defense. But Duke is kind of another level of talented. You know, you go down the list of, you know, whether it's Dyson Williams is going to be the guy that beat you, whether it's going to be Brendan O'Neill, you know, it goes on and on and on. And, you know, I'm curious how Penn is going to be able to handle that high powered offense. I don't think that they're going to play an Ivy League team that I think there's Ivy League teams that are more talented in spots than Duke, but I don't think there's an Ivy League team that has just the depth of offensive talent as Duke. So that's really what I'm looking forward to is how Penn is able to kind of muscle through that. And, you know, on the other end, their offense has just got to be a lot better than it was this past weekend. They can be better. I love Dylan Gergar. I think Jack Schultz is a really, really underrated player who's going to have a breakthrough season. And Sam Hanley is the guy that, you know, the Sam Hanley hype train was rolling into that game. And I don't think he had his best showing, and I'm sure he knows it. And he was matched up against possibly the best defender in the land in Will Bowen. But he's never going to have an easy defender to play in the Ivy League, and, you know, certainly not this weekend against Duke. So you need to see more from him.
Moving right along, number 5, Rutgers, is at number 19, Loyola. Greyhounds looking for a win at home. This game is at noon, and it's available on ESPN+.
Yeah, Rutgers has been one of those teams that, I don't know, I think a lot of people, in the similar way as the Ivy League, you didn't know what exactly to expect from Rutgers because they graduated that attack line that had so many points. I think maybe Brian Brecht has not gotten the credit he's deserved for the amount of contributors up and down the roster who are homegrown Rutgers players. So much of the focus has been on those transfers. And, hey, Mitch Bartolo is a tremendous player. Ronan Jacoby is a tremendous player. I'm saying this realizing that probably 3 of their top 4 point scorers are transfers right now. But you got someone like Ross Scott, who has kind of been running the show offensively. You know, he's a homegrown Rutgers guy who, you know, was recruited and has been developed by Brecht and Coach Eric Saramet. You know, Ryan Gallagher is a midfielder the same way. Shane Knobloch is still young in his career, but, you know, he's another one of those Rutgers guys. So, you know, it's kind of like seeing that thing of like, I still think the core of this team, despite all these transfers, are guys who have kind of lived in this NASCAR offensive system, lived under the way that, you know, Brecht and Saramet have kind of run this program. So I think that's why you're still seeing some of the continuity in terms of the results. You know, it definitely, the Army win was a good win, 13-10, and then the way that they were able to, you know, maybe withstand them coming back. And it's a very good team. They have Brendan Nichter, who is one of the best attackmen in the country. And, you know, Rutgers defense maybe has unnecessarily been criticized in recent years. Again, going back to our Big Ten conversation, I think it's just that Rutgers defense was playing against some of the best offensive players in the country week in and week out. So, you know, this stretch here with Loyola and then Stony Brook and then Princeton after that is really going to be telling, I think, exactly who Rutgers is. They're not going to put up, you know, 23 goals and 15 goals like they have in some of these early games against teams that they're clearly better than. But, you know, is Rutgers legit? I think we're going to find out by mid-March if that's the case.
Now this Loyola Greyhound team, desperately in need of a win, taking on a formidable opponent this week. Who's going to play goal for the Greyhounds?
You know, I don't know. Like, I think if you're Coach Toomey, like, do you kind of have to really try to ride Sam Schaefer as your guy, the guy who made the big save at the end of the big save in, I think, 2 or 3 games at the end of last year? Try to build some confidence in him and work on the other aspects of the field that need some help and just try to develop some confidence in your goaltender. He's a goalie. He knows a lot better than I do the psyche of a goaltender. But, you know, I kind of feel like you got to find a guy and ride with him. If you have more than one goalie, you don't have one, I guess is the old expression. You know, I think you got to make a decision. I would think that Schaefer has the leg up for his experience. And, you know, you got to work on those short sticks. Those short sticks are in bad shape right now.
Moving to the ACC, number 9, Syracuse, 1-1 now on the season. Travels to Charlottesville to take on the number 2, Virginia Cavaliers, who are 3-0. That game's at noon, and you can watch that on ACC Network.
Well, remember, Syracuse beat Virginia twice last year, you know, when Virginia won the national championship. I think it just, you know, speaks to the depth of talent that there is in the ACC. I think Virginia is a much better, more complete team. That does not mean that Syracuse is out of this game by any stretch of the imagination. Going back to this Maryland game, you know, I think there was a little bit of a thought in, you know, in the back of my mind that this Maryland team is that good and this Syracuse team has enough question marks, despite being very talented, that is it going to be a 7-goal game? Is it going to be an 8-goal game? I thought, proved something with the 14-10 victory. You know, I think this is going to come down to, as a lot of top games do, injuries. You know, what's the status of Matt Moore? If he does play, does he play 100%? You know, obviously that's a Tuorton caliber player right there that, though I think Virginia is better equipped than most teams to deal with the loss of an attackman, given, you know, they have the number one incoming attackman, Griffin Schutz, kind of waiting in the wings, and he can easily shift down. And they have Connor Schellenberger, who can, you know, kind of run that offense as a QB. That's fine. But, you know, the face-off is the other area that goes with that. So injuries and face-off, you know, Faulp versus P.D. LaSala. You know, LaSala is a guy who I think is one of the – he could be the first team All-American at the face-off position. And I say this being someone who loves Mike Sistelberger and what he does at Lehigh. LaSala's ability to create offense himself, you know, just run down and score. He has more offensive touch than most face-off guys in the country. But then just being able to muck it up and play the technician game if he needs to as well. I think he's arguably the best face-off guy in the country. And you know, we'll see another top-tier matchup for him coming up this weekend against Jacob Faulp.
What do you think the over-under in this game is? Total goal score, 30? More than 30?
Oof. I'm notoriously bad at this. Though I did get the under right. I said it was my bet of the weekend last week was UMBC Drexel. I want to say that it was set at 22, and I said the under, and it was a 10-8 game. So I guess I had something right. But, yeah, I'll go with 29.5, 14-15 game.
Okay. All right. It's mid-range. Okay. Yeah, that should be a great one. And you can watch that again on ACC Network at noon.
The Syracuse, Virginia, it's the game that launched Inside the Cross, as we like to say here, that famous shootout where there was almost 60 goals was the first weekend that Inside the Cross, the newsletter that Bob Carpenter started, was published. So that was a game near and dear to the history of Inside the Cross. And it's been maybe not that good every year since, but it's always been a pretty darn good matchup every year.
Moving on to maybe the game of the week, Matt, is number 3 Georgetown travel out to South Bend to take on number 4 Notre Dame at 1 o'clock on ACC Network Plus.
This is awesome. This is, you know, I want to say, you know, we're putting out our weekly cover that we do, and it's the headline that we have tentative, not finalized, is defensive dominance. And both these teams, I think, are the number 1 and number 2 defenses in the country. I think Georgetown is a little more established in that fact, you know, given some of the consistency in personnel that they return. But Notre Dame, you know, you could just plug any guys out there and with the defense that, you know, Ryan Wallner runs and then Jerry Byrne before him at Notre Dame, they're going to be one of the best defenses in the country no matter what. You know, I think that they arguably the top 2 goalies in the country. I love Arden Cohen kind of being the focal point of that Notre Dame defense. Obviously, Will Bowen, the job that he did last week and, you know, has done for North Carolina prior to being at Georgetown speaks for itself. So I want to say that this is going to be some sort of defensive slugfest, but that is really just like discounting how much offensive firepower that they have on both of these teams. I'm really looking forward to the midfields in this game. You know, Graham Bundy is kind of the alpha there for Georgetown, and the Missouri native, Missouri big this week in lacrosse with Lindenwood announcing that they're going to go D1. Dylan Hess is just this guy that like does absolutely, he's the best multi-tool midfielder in the country right now in terms of ability to play defense, stay out on wings, score goals. He's just so good. And then Notre Dame just has so many guys that like, I don't know, you kind of like, I don't want to say you forget about them, but it's just, you know, whether it's Wheaton Jacoboyce or Meyer, Quinn McCann, you know, there's just all these guys who are just really good players on Notre Dame's, you know, midfield. And then when you look at the Cavanaughs, who are just kind of next level in terms of their excitement to watch, you know, I don't necessarily think that this is going to be a defensive game. I think this is going to be like one of those games that is just at every single phase of the field executed at such a high level that you're just going to be like a fan of, no matter if you're a fan of either team, you're just going to be a fan of watching the execution. It's going to be so awesome. I think this is clearly, this might be the game of the year so far.
Wow.
Not the game of the weekend. So really looking forward to this. Like I said, you know, 2 awesome defenses, but particularly Notre Dame, I think they don't give enough credit for how many good offensive players they have on that team. And, you know, the Cavanaughs are just another level of excitement. We saw that against Detroit Mercy. Curious to see when the competition ratchets up the chemistry between the two brothers out there.
So what do you think the goal over under in this one is? If we said 30 in the Cuse Virginia game, 20, this is like a 10-9 type of game.
I think it's, I don't know, 13-12, 14-13. I'm going to go a little higher. I think the defense is very good, but I think you need a lot of work to get them, but you're going to get the goals.
Well, that game should be great to watch. Again, it's at 1 o'clock. Fans can see that on the ACC network. Check out ESPN streaming for that. Moving on, another game of top 20 matchups. Number 20, Princeton, for 2-0 now after the win against Binghamton on Tuesday, will take on number 1, Maryland in College Park. The Terps are 3-0. That game's at 1 o'clock, and you can see that one on Big Ten Plus.
So this is the game that, you know, I just said that the Georgetown-Notre Dame game is the game of the year so far. This is the game that I might find the most compelling, most interesting, because I don't think we have a clear idea of how good Princeton is, and I think they might be exceptionally good because, you know, Maryland's, like, it's almost not, like, they're phenomenal in every facet. You know, I know Bubba Fairman kind of became the, like, the discussion of Lax Twitter this week and people are calling him overhyped. No. If Bubba Fairman needed to be an offensive midfielder, he could score 20 goals for the Maryland Terrapins this year, no doubt. He took on a new role because they have so many good offensive midfielders and they have an injury, you know, with Alex Smith being out, that it makes sense for him to be the leader that he is. And if you've met anyone who's encountered him, his leadership has been a part of the reason for a lot of his hype, not just his offensive production. So Maryland, good in every phase. You know, I think that they have the ability to let loose a little bit more than maybe in some other years and kind of have some transition. And Bubba's a big part of that, but that midfield is awesome. But Princeton, you know, and I'm not trying to predict that Princeton's going to win this game because, like I said, I think Maryland is as complete as you can be right now as a team. Princeton, we haven't seen anything from them over the past 2 years. You know, they were in that weird spot where, you know, there was Penn that kind of kept practicing on campus. Princeton was one of those teams where basically they, you know, players unenrolled, you know, they weren't together. A lot of them unenrolled. A lot of them lived together though in various parts of the country and kind of were able to do some individual work. And I talked to Chris Brown this week, who sneakily has scored a goal in every game of his career. And he really credited that stepping away, figuring out what it is you love about the game and working on yourselves as individuals and in small groups, but without, you know, coaching staff and without, you know, all of the structure of practice and how that may pay off for the team, you know, each. And I think the assistant coaches did a good job of giving those guys some direction of like, hey, this is the skill you need to work on. This is the thing that you need to be better at during this downtime. So I think individually, each player is going to be a little bit more of a well-rounded version of themselves. And that's going to make the offense pretty scary. We haven't seen a lot of these guys, but, you know, look, Alex Slusher is a phenomenal player who just, you know, if he'd been playing the past 3 years, we'd be talking about him a lot more. Jake Stevens is going to be a fixture of Team Canada. He's just one of those multi-tool midfielder guys. I love the midfield in terms of just so many athletic guys who do a lot of things. Sam English, Alex Wardero, who I think a lot of people thought maybe was going to be an attackman, but as of right now, Tommy Barnes kind of took that third spot. Bo Peterson, Sean Cameron, who's, you know, kind of a newcomer to this team. Their defense is just big and bulky and scary. George Bond obviously is, you know, the focal point of that. Princeton can be really good. And talking to Coach Madelon this week, they're still a work in progress. And that's kind of even scarier, you know, like I would love it if it was Princeton, Maryland on February 26th and then also again on like April 5th. Because I would love to see the progression of these teams as, you know, Princeton being a little bit more of a ball of clay that, you know, kind of needs to be turned into something. And Maryland right now being, you know, a pretty complete product.
I've watched each of Princeton's first two games against Monmouth and Binghamton, and they won handily in each of those matchups. And what I'm excited for from this game is really, we know how good Maryland is. And this will be the ultimate barometer game to see how good Princeton can be, is right now, but can be this season as well. So I want to see how they measure up, and I'm really excited for this game on Saturday.
Yeah, absolutely. And just to, you know, kind of one more point here is Princeton built in more scrimmages to its preseason than normal, purposely for this very reason of like, we don't know necessarily who we are yet. And I kept hearing in February, Princeton's really good. And, you know, now we see actual results that count for something and it's, oh my God, they are really good. And what about Michael Sauer's number 22 calling the game on Watch ESPN on February 22nd and them scoring 22 goals. Come on. That's a sign right there.
He did a really nice job too. He obviously knows the players and the team and the game really well. And it was great to listen to him. All right, Matt, our last game of the day features the number 3 Jacksonville Dolphins taking on the number 16 Denver Pioneers out in Denver. Who would have ever thought going into this season that Jacksonville would be the higher ranked team in this game and that the Pios may be even considered underdogs on their home field for this one? Before we get into discussing this game, I'd like to bring in Coach John Galloway, the head coach of the Dolphins. Had a chance to sit down with him this week, talk about his program and the success that they've had so far prior to their trip. Let's bring in Coach Galloway. Guest this week on the Deep Fly Dixon podcast is John Galloway, head coach of the 3-1 Jacksonville Dolphins. Coach, thanks for joining us on the Deep Fly Dixon podcast.
I'm excited to be a part of it. I've had a chance to listen to you guys and love what you do, especially, you know, I think everybody's got the itch to get lacrosse and your podcast being back is a sign of lacrosse in the spring here to stay.
Thank you. Well, one of the big surprises and one of the fun things to watch so far this season has been the play of your team. Obviously, you had a great win over Duke. Some have said that win over number 3 Duke in Durham was your program's biggest win in your history. And maybe it was. But more importantly, that puts you in the top 20 rankings for the first time in school history. And that's definitely significant. You're up to number 13 in this week's poll. What's that meant for your emerging program to be ranked among the top 20 teams?
Yeah, I think there's so many ways to look at the rankings. And I think the easy thing to say is don't worry about the numbers. It's February. But I think the truth is it's twofold. You know, number one, for the guys in our locker room, it doesn't mean anything. You know, our focus has to be Denver and Air Force coming up and our ability to continue to play this level across and get better. You know, it's for us, our end goal is in May still, and we have to get better as a team on a daily basis. But I'd be naive to say it doesn't mean anything. It's significant for our program, for the alumni that have come before us, for the families that have built this facility, to the administration that gave us a chance to build this program the right way. So while, you know, I think on a micro level, we're focusing on Denver and the opportunity to prove that, you know, we belong in the top 20. On a more global scale, obviously for our program, it is significant and means a lot to us as we hopefully continue to build this thing moving forward.
I want to touch on that for a little longer. Your women's team also ranked in the top 20. What kind of support? Obviously, you're getting great support from your administration, from probably the president's office all the way down through your athletic department. What does that mean, especially with the Rock Lacrosse Center and the facilities that you have and even your 88 club? You know, can you talk a little bit about that institutional support from your alumni and your higher ups at Jacksonville?
Yeah, one of the first things I always like to share is you know, my thanks and gratitude towards our athletic director, Alex Ricker-Gilbert, who got the job about a month before I was hired. So I was his first hire. And then President Cost, who really has allowed this vision to come to fruition. So when I was on the golf cart and I was on my interview process, you know, we didn't have locker rooms. We didn't have coaching offices. Our field was shared with the football stadium. We were in our infancy as a program. And both of those gentlemen have made this thing a reality. And it starts with a little bit of vision and what men's and women's lacrosse could be. And women's lacrosse is really the pioneer. You know, they have been consistently champions in their conference and NCAA tournament appearances. And we just stole a little bit of their mojo and tried to build off of that and allowed us to get some momentum with our alumni and our families. And, you know, one of the things that's unique here at JU, and I think in the past with my experiences, is sometimes you can draw a line between players and their families and the coaching staff. at this place, we wouldn't have gotten to this state without the support of our families and their willingness to help. So we kind of gray that line a little bit because we needed everybody to make this a reality. And obviously it started with our administration. It was supported by our alumni and our families. And now you're starting to see the fruits of their labor. And they just really gave us a chance to essentially have no excuses from facilities to scholarships, to operating budget, to operational support through the ADA club. We don't have an excuse here to not win, and we just have to prove ourselves on the field now.
Your program started in 2010, and there were a few other programs in the Southern Conference that were contemporaries in terms of their start time, Richmond, High Point in particular. The three of you have really helped shine a light on the Southern Conference as a lacrosse conference, and you've been elevated rather quickly when you think of, you know, the history of your programs and the lacrosse landscape. How has the SoCon become so strong and competitive on a national level in such a short amount of time, in your opinion?
I think there's high aspirations. I think there's some dreamers in our conference. You know, I think Coach Shamadi had a standard for what he wanted Richmond to be. And obviously that academic profile of that place and where it's located on I-95, you were going to be able to attract high level kids that saw an opportunity. And High Point, same thing. I mean, if you hear anything about High Point and their campus and what it's like, and I think it was a, you know, Coach Torpy's mentality of his work ethic and his willingness to do what's required to get there along with that campus allowed them to really upgrade their profile. And for us here, we're so unique. We're so different than Richmond and High Point in so many ways, specifically at the university level, but we're geographically such a unique option. And, you know, it's ironic that we're going to play Denver this weekend, because in my interview process, that's the program I brought up, a place that's geographically diverse in terms of who they can recruit. But we have to be like the Disney World of Florida. You know, when you're a kid, you go to Florida, it's probably to go to Disney. And how can we create that profile for a young man who wants to go play college lacrosse in a unique area where, you know, in Denver, you can go out to the mountains and ski and have that experience. Well, in Florida, you're going to be able to come here and play lacrosse in the sunshine for most of the year. And we're also going to be able to surround you with the tools to be successful. So I think each of us had a different path to getting here in the Southern Conference, and Mercer, the same thing. I think Mercer's done a great job with some of their talent, but we have to be consistent if we want the SoCon to stick around, and we have to continue to build on that profile. And it is allowed by teams like Virginia and Duke and UNC willing to play us. If they weren't willing to play us, we'd be in a much different position. And I always, win or lose, you know, look to thank Coach Shanowski for being willing to play us every year, because he doesn't have to. He certainly could just say no to us, and we would probably float around 11 or 12 games and be figuring it out. But guys like that allow teams like us in Richmond and High Point to grow, because they're willing to put us on the schedule when they don't have to.
Yeah, I would imagine that certainly helps in your recruiting, the opportunity to play those ACC schools. Some of it is the convenient geography, especially for High Point and Richmond, that helps garner attention for the SoCon early in the season with those non-conference games against ACC teams, because of the eyeballs of hungry lacrosse fans like me who are dying to see lacrosse in February and early March in the non-conference season. And those are the games that I can watch, you know, on TV. And it certainly shines a light on your program. About that recruiting aspect of it, again, you're a young program and you continually get better recruits and build on the success that you're having. How do you balance the challenge of selling freshmen and high school players on the opportunities that you have and the chance to play sometimes right away with the new reality of COVID redshirt years and the transfer portal that everyone is tapping into? How do you balance that in your recruiting message?
Well, I think first, you know, our message is, hey, this is a place that's going to surround you with not just the academic atmosphere, the gated campus community. We also have a lifestyle. Jacksonville is a lifestyle. It's located next to a major city. Our guys do live at the beach, which is about 9 miles away. So first of all, we're going to surround you with a well-rounded atmosphere. The second piece of it is it's going to be a focus on development and your willingness to be 1/55th of the team. And that's why we talk about the transfer a lot. A lot of people gave me flack for, you know, the transfer portal and how invested we were in it early. It wasn't to replace our recruits. It was to supplement the talent that we already had on the roster. And I think you see it with our welcomeness in our locker room. Max Waldbaum transfers in from Tufts, and he's voted captain, not by the coaching staff and not just by getting a third of the votes. I mean, he had super majority. He had over 40 votes by his teammates to be voted captain. And I think it sings to the eagerness of this team and this program and the support around it to get good and to get good consistently. So we have to invest in the young men and development of the freshmen. And we've played a lot of freshmen, but we also have to invest in being able to give kids second chances and give opportunities to come and pursue their graduate school. And we do have 1 year graduate and 1 year MBA program. So how can we mesh that together, knowing that we're not going to be able to ever beat Duke one with one way or the other? We have to have a little bit of everything working in our favor, just like we do on the field. So it's complimentary lacrosse, just like it's complimentary recruiting. And we're going to continue to stay on that path.
So you have 25 new players and 10 are transfers, but 15 are freshmen, and you're getting contributions from the older guys and the younger guys as well. What do you and your staff do to blend the players that have been here with new people to the program in such an unusual time as well, with, you know, COVID restrictions and how often you can get together and things like that?
Yeah, I think we sacrificed a little bit more time this year than ever in the fall of committing to getting those guys to be in the same room together. That was something that we didn't have over the last 2 years. And we just felt like there's so many things that we do in the fall, yet very few of them carry over to the spring. So let's invest a little bit more time in getting these guys in the same room, developing consistent mentorship groups where they're actually spending real time together, not just one-off meetings. And then let's focus on understanding what the roles of each player are. And that's what we focused on the fall, on the offensive and defensive side. And what you're starting to see is this camaraderie. You know, the goalie room is a great example. You know, we have Jason Yoquino, who's an all-conference goalie, transfer from Albany. And then Luke Milliken comes in as a transfer from North Carolina, fifth-year senior. And then Ryan Delarocco comes in as a freshman and plays meaningful minutes last week against Marquette and has 10 saves in the second half. Well, how can we make that room the goalie room? You know, how can we more refer to that as the bullpen versus the one and then everybody else? And I think that type of communication is really important, that those guys knew it from day one, that we weren't trying to uplift Jason from his spot, but we were going to create the most competitive goalie bullpen that we could in the country. And they rallied around that. And I think it's little messaging like that on day one versus, you know, that day before the game when you announce a starter, that allowed those guys to continue to stay together. And, you know, ultimately, you know, we talk a lot about, you know, when catastrophe hits, fall on your credo. And our credo, our core values, the Duval mission, those four words are ingrained into our guys' heads. And it means that you have to earn it all the time. So you're a transfer, you earn it. If you're a freshman, you earn it. There is no free golden ticket given out, regardless of how you got to this program. Once you get here, you got to earn everything. And that's, you know, that's one of our four core values for a reason. It's because of the way we recruit.
Your breakout star so far this season has been attackman Max Waldbaum, who is a grad student transfer from Tufts, where he had a really nice career in a really tough Division III league. But I'll be honest and say I was a little surprised to see how well he's played and the numbers he's putting up. He's got 21 points in four games, scored a lot of goals for you, averaging four goals a game. National Player of the Week by a lot of people while he's played a lot. And it's just a great story. How did he make his way to Jacksonville? Can you expand on his growing legend a little bit?
Yeah, it's such an exciting one. It's funny when you guys released the transfer rankings, I sent that to Max right away, and I texted Terry and I said, hey, thanks for the bulletin board material, because that is what Max thrives on. Max thrives on playing at Tufts and playing against Dartmouth last year. I mean, we've talked about that game at nauseam. He wants to prove that there's a lot of people that missed his recruitment process when he was out at Kent Denver. And then when he was coming through the transfer portal, but his path here was really unique. We zoomed with him as a staff about an hour before our Utah game last year. And then we didn't hear from him for like 2 months. And I'm like, okay, I guess we should probably move on. Max probably isn't a reality. And we knew of, you know, his ability, and the Tufts guys were so complimentary of him, but we just weren't sure. And then he came a couple months later and said, hey, I'd like to be part of it. And man, we were blown away. We were excited. We were thrilled. And when he got here, what we didn't realize was his competitive edge. You know, his value on the field is significant, but he'll approach a 2v1 ground ball drill like he does the overtime of the Hopkins game. I mean, it is incredible how competitive he is on a daily basis. I have to pull him out of drills at practice because he won't stop. So he's changed our culture already to create an atmosphere of competition on a daily basis. And, you know, there's not many guys that can come in and have that dramatic of an impact, but he has, and he's done it in a really unique way. And we're thrilled to have him. I mean, he's got 2 years of eligibility, and I think every week he's showing the country, hey, this is something that I've been waiting for. You know, I've been kind of waiting in the wings, and he doesn't like to say much. He likes to work in the dark a little bit, but he has been such a joy to work with.
The fact that he was voted a captain by his peers and his teammates really speaks a lot about his makeup, his impact on the team, and his leadership. But he's mixing with two really young guys on the attack unit. And that's a good, you know, big picture, high level look at your entire team, like a mix of youth and experience. So you have these two young Philly area guys who round out your attack. What can you say about the play of Jacob Kreiner and Jackson Intrary?
Yeah, Jacob's such a, he's another captain for us, named a captain as a redshirt sophomore. And his captaincy was strictly based on his work ethic. He broke his hand last year in the beginning of the season, and he would go out and shoot with a cast on his hand every day until he came back, and he scored 5 goals against Mercer his first game back. So it's just his work ethic. And then Jackson Trey, we call him J.I., you know, he's like the AI of hoops. We're trying to get him to be like the point guard. He's a young man, was committed to your sinus this summer. And, you know, we had heard through the rumblings that he was interested in playing at the Division I level. He had 160 points at the high school level last year. And we just felt like, man, this is the first time we've had an attackman where we can give the ball to and let him operate a little bit at X. So he's getting comfortable every week. He's still a freshman, but man, you see some flashes at practice where you're like, this is fun. This is fun to know that this unit could be back together. And they're starting to develop some chemistry as well. And like you said, it's young and old, but, you know, they're doing their part right now on that side of the ball.
I want to talk about your scheduling a little bit. You know, you mentioned two of the games, your Hopkins game and your Mercer game. Mercer's on your schedule twice, another SoCon opponent. I want to ask you about that. But you started the year playing at Johns Hopkins. It's a new game for Hopkins, new opponent for you. How did that game come about?
Yeah, Coach Millman reached out. We had a tentative game on the schedule, and I took that game when Coach reached out and with our staff, and I sat down and we said, you know, do we want to do this? And the fear was, well, if you play them and then you got to go to Durham right away, you know, with this group that we're bringing back and we felt confident about, are we willing to be 0-2 and know that our team could handle that? Do we have the character to handle that? And ultimately, you know, Coach Brzezinski at one point in the meeting said, hey, if one of our core values is to be fearless, we can't be fearful on our scheduling. So that was ultimately the decision, and I'm glad we did it. I don't, obviously very disappointed with the outcome, but I don't know if we have any success in Durham without that experience. I think we felt like we belonged on the field, and despite the 21 turnovers and some sloppy play and a typical February 5th game on both sides, we walked off Homewood saying, okay, you know, this is that we have something here. And I think that propelled us into Durham, and obviously hopefully we'll continue to do so going into Denver this weekend.
Yeah. Very impressive how you followed up your big win over Duke with 2 solid wins in a 3-0 week. I saw a video online of you talking in the locker room after your win against Marquette, and I could just see the excitement in the locker room and on your players of real accomplishment. And it's early in the season, but you guys are off to a fantastic start. But you backed up the Duke win with a win over Mercer. It's what good teams do. You know, you come back and you bounce back from a win, and you get the job done in your next game on short preparation. This non-conference game against Mercer, was it just to get another game against the travel convenience there?
Yeah, last year we did it because everybody was so concerned with COVID, and we knew that this was a bus trip. We could do it on a day. There was no hotels involved. And Coach Sherman and I just said, you know, our guys want to play more games. It's a night game. It's in Savannah. It's a really cool atmosphere. And you know, let's just do it again. Let's run it back. And after the Duke game, you're regretting it a little bit, you know, having to get on an 8-hour bus ride and then have to turn it around Tuesday morning to drive up there. But we said exactly what you shared is, you know, good teams, every once in a while, they'll have a special win. Great teams can build off of that momentum, and we needed to build off of it. And I thought for 3 quarters we did. In the 4th quarter, I wasn't terribly thrilled with how we played, but I thought, you know, this was a moment for us to prove ourselves, and we did it for the most part on Tuesday, and then again on Saturday, which, you know, you could see the fatigue start to set in, and Marquette's defense, I think, is special, and we had to kind of kind of sloppily fight our way through that. But to find a way to go 3-0 that week, I think hopefully builds dividends for us later on in the season.
We'll change pace here just for a second. On a personal side, this past August, you decided to retire from your playing career, a remarkable career, national championships, world championships, lots of personal accolades, all deserving. How did you know when it was time to hang them up?
I think finally when Joel said he was willing to do it, I think I would have a fear of not, you know, already missing the team and the group chat, but, you know, not being able to do it with him like I have since, 2008. That was like affirmation for me that, okay, it is time. And I also think, you know, I love playing. I am so passionate about it, but there's some point where you can't give 100% to both. And I felt like it, you know, these guys at everything that Jacksonville has done for me, I owe it to them to give more of myself. And it was a perfect time for me and my wife to say, okay, you know, let's take a step back and let's really invest back into JU and allow the next great goalies to take over. Cause I certainly wasn't the best ball stopper in the beginning and I definitely wasn't at the end. And you know, I thought it was a time for me to let that next wave take over and try to be a supporter as much as I can off the field, but reinvest in JU and what we're doing here.
Dixie wants me to ask you, what's up with the sweatpants when you were playing? Where's that, the story behind that? Or why did you always rock the long sweatpants?
You know, I wish I had a better story. In eighth grade, so you used to be able to go practice with the high school team in the mornings in the winter. So I obviously, that was my dream. I wanted to play varsity lacrosse at Western SC. That was like the pinnacle of lacrosse at the time. And, you know, they used to go play on the Camillus Pool parking lot, you know, in the mornings. And Andrew Hanover and Drew Dabrowski and all those greats back then let me come. And I remember I wore sweatpants one day and I, you know, made a couple saves on Hanover and a couple saves on Brian Cost. And it was like, oh my God, these pants are like magical. And from that day on, I didn't take them off. I played one game in Empires with shorts and we lost to Long Island, like, you know, by a lot. And that was it. And that was, I was like, okay, that's just a reminder never to take these things off, and stayed with me all the way through to the end.
That's great. Yeah. That's great. Well, you got to stick with what's working for you, right?
Yep.
Hey, so this weekend, you guys travel to Colorado for a tough back-to-back. You play number 16 Denver on Saturday, and then you travel down to Colorado Springs for your old SoCon rival, Air Force. How do you prepare for a trip like that? Two games in 2 days after long travel at high altitude and against two formidable opponents?
Yeah, I think, you know, we have to physically prepare for two and we have to mentally prepare for one. You know, there's nothing to look past that other than Denver at 12 o'clock in their stadium. And I think the message has been pretty clear. It's, you know, this is it's a challenge for us to prove ourselves. It's to prove, you know, a little bit of the analogy I keep using is like a forced entry. I don't know if teams really want to vote for us. I don't know if teams really are, you know, totally keen to the idea that Jacksonville is a top 20 program. And it's our job to have a little bit more of a forced entry mindset that we are here to stay. It wasn't a one game thing. But you only do that with execution. You only do that with incredible discipline on a trip like that. You know, for example, we wear suit and tie on the planes. And I told the guys, lay out your suit and tie tonight. You know, that's we need to be disciplined from right now until we get on that plane. And then when we step on the field, it doesn't start at 12 o'clock. And if we can have that mentality of professionalism and discipline and maturity over 48 hours, we have a chance to do something special. But it starts with being able to try to go 1-0 against an elite offense, a team that's going to come off angry after that last Duke game for them and at their place. So it's going to, you know, we're going to have our work cut out for us, but I think our guys like the Hopkins game, we scheduled this for a reason and they're excited at the chance to prove it.
Yeah. How helpful is it to have film of a team playing a team that you recently played against, you know, with a common opponent in Duke before you head out there or against anyone, really? I'm not trying to get your game plan necessarily, but just that idea.
Yeah, I think it's really unique for us this weekend that Denver's played Air Force. So we can kind of watch that one film and really dissect it in a 48-hour window of, hey, we're playing everybody here. And what do we look like compared to them as pieces on the chessboard? But their offense is special. I mean, we need to be playmakers. We think our defense is pretty darn good. But, you know, I wrote some numbers on the board the other day that they thought were rankings. They were goals against. And I feel like we haven't proven ourselves in our goals against yet and what we've given up in the first four games. And I know guys like Colin Hinn and Dixon Smith and the guys in the back end are taking that personally. So there is no, comfort in where we are right now. And I think building a little bit of a discomfort in our locker room has been a good thing this week.
All right. I appreciate your time. I have one more question for you. We usually ask all the coaches this when we end. So when you want to get away from lacrosse, what does John Galloway do to relax? Is it you listen to music? Is it movies, TV? Like, what is it that you do when you want to get away from lacrosse for a bit?
Yeah, my wife and I, we spend a lot of time with our pit bull dog, Maverick. That's a big getaway for me. You know, we have our morning gym class. That's kind of our ritual that like allows me to get away from everything. And we are definitely big office people. So office is on, and at least in the background, even if I'm doing film, the office is usually on. But that's my home is kind of my oasis right now. And I have a really supportive wife that, you know, allows me to come home and take a deep breath and doesn't force me to go out to dinner every night. So we got a good little thing going right now.
All right. Three top favorite office characters.
Oh man. Well, I, you know, the Jim and Pam romance, I'm a romantic. So I like Jim and Pam. Dwight, sure. Obviously Dwight's my guy. You know, the next one's a difficult one. I think Oscar's funny. Our Chrome group chat is pretty much just, you know, between Wolf and Rannigan, pretty much just office quotes. So I get a little bit of taste of everything. And but Dwight Schrute's probably the most popular quoted guy in our group chat for sure.
Man, what is a great show.
It sure is. It's one that you can turn on every night, and still, I mean, it could be the sixth time you've watched the episode of the dinner party or whatever it may be, and it's like you get locked in right away. So I have to turn it off sometimes when I'm early in the week getting ready for film, but later in the week, I allow myself to enjoy a few.
No one ever says Michael Scott. Whenever I ask this question, I get a lot of Dwights, but no one ever says Michael Scott. That's
I know.
All right, John, I really appreciate your time. Thank you for joining us on the podcast, and seriously, best of luck this weekend with your two games and throughout the rest of the season. And we hope to get to talk to you again sometime this year.
I appreciate you having me. Thanks.
Matt, it's so great to talk to a young head coach who is so impressive and has such a great handle on who he is, who he wants his program to be, and where they are. It's there's big things headed for the Jacksonville Dolphins and John Galloway as in his coaching career.
For sure. And, you know, it's a reason why every time that there's talk of who's going to be the next head coach at, you know, whatever prestigious lacrosse playing institution you're talking about, John Galloway's name, you know, is always kind of put in there by outsiders, is because he is that impressive and his clear vision for the program and what he wants to make it. And, you know, which I think is, it's Jacksonville is a place that's unique, and he has leaned into the uniqueness of Jacksonville and kind of made it his own. Really impressive job that he's done. And, you know, I know one of the things he talks about with you is the diversity in terms of, they, like Denver, are like an outlier in terms of geographic where they're at, you know, not being necessarily in a hotbed or, you know, a 45-minute drive from, you know, your closest opponent or anything like that. But the way he's found guys from all over, he has a very geographically diverse roster. He has a very racially diverse roster, which is something I know he's very proud of, and, you know, really worked to make that into the fabric of his program. And he also has guys he's willing to take chances on, who, whether they're transfers who didn't work out someplace else, guys who are looking for a fresh change of scenery. You've seen D3 guys, Max Waldbaum, obviously being the guy who has been getting a lot of attention this year. You know, anyone who watched any of the Tufts and D3 knew he was going to be at least an impact player at this level. Maybe not to this extent, but knew that he was going to be a guy who was going to be playing capable minutes and scoring goals. And then, you know, he's got an MCLA guy on his roster too, as well, a guy from Florida State. So, you know, and the thing that just jumps out to me is like, they're athletic, and when you look at that Duke game, they were confident. They have been playing this year not like they are an underdog in any of these games. You know, they've been playing like they belong there.
He said that the Hopkins game for their team and their mindset really proved to them that they belong. And he said that gave them great confidence when they went to Durham to play Duke. And it was really interesting to hear him. One of the questions I asked him was how they're blending this roster together. There's 25 new guys this year. And he said, you know, there's 15 freshmen, and they are from all over the place. and there's 10 transfers. And he said he's been knocked for the transfers that he's taken. But he said, I believe in giving guys second chances. And I like when guys want to prove themselves, whether you're coming from MCLA, Division III, another Division I program. You know, if you want to join what we're building at Jacksonville, we got a place for you. And he said they're getting great support from their administration, as well as, you know, he's got a model. He said, you know, look, we're different than Denver. Don't get me wrong. In a lot of respects, but sort of being that geographic outlier a little bit has been, they have something they can wrap their heads around, you know, and it's been a great model because of the success that Denver's had. But that's a tough back-to-back. Yeah. Really tough. Anytime you're playing two games on a weekend, it's really hard. Against opponents like that, it makes it even more difficult. And then when you have to add in the travel to the Rocky Mountains.
Well, and you said to this, you know, it might be like, wow, Jacksonville might be like kind of the favorite in this. One thing though, I mean, you're playing Bill Tierney. It's tough to be the favorite when you're playing Bill Tierney, no matter who you are. But I will say that I do really like Denver's midfield. You know, I feel like they're much more of a midfield driven offense with Sullivan and Simmons. They do need to get more out of Jack Hanna though. I think him having three goals on, I think he's about 40 shots. You know, he's always been a volume shooter, but I think they need to figure something out there and get him going. Because that can go from a really good midfield to an elite one, you know, with him playing at his full potential. But I'm really looking forward to this one. And then, I mean, if obviously some stuff has got to shake out, but if Jacksonville were to win that, I mean, you're looking at maybe a top 10 team, right? Like, depending on what, you know, some of the people ahead of them do. Pressure's on, John, you know, like, let's see what happens. But, you know, that's, it's kind of buzz they're getting, and hey, they've deserved it. And, you know, they've, you know, they certainly made some big strides this year that are going to have a lasting impact on their program. But again, it's February, so put it together, you know. And I did a story about Hobart this week, and I don't know if I used this quote in the story, but one of the things that Greg Raymond said is that, you know, a true test of a season is endurance. So how do you endure in terms of an entire span of a year? It's easy to have a great month, or it's not easy to have a great month, but great months happen. You know, great 60 days, a great 90 days, a great full season is a lot tougher, and that kind of separates the men from the boys.
All right, Matt, on Sunday, there's one game that I will be hyper-focused on when my number 11 Johns Hopkins Blue Jays travel down to Chapel Hill to face the number 12th ranked North Carolina Tar Heels, who are 3-1 after their midweek win over Brown. That game's 2 o'clock. We'll be streaming on ESPN+.
North Carolina really liked the fact that they did bounce back from that Ohio State loss. You know, that was, it was a bad loss against Ohio State. Like, let's just put it, like, they were overmatched in every aspect. And, you know, it got to a point where you just felt like they didn't want to be there anymore because they were getting beat so bad. So that's the kind of loss that you need to have a palate cleanser. I don't think they were perfect against Brown by any means. But I do think that Cole Herbert having four goals, Jacob Kelly playing really well, I think you started to see a little bit of the, you know, we don't need to just have Chris Gray do everything for us to be good. Now, Chris Gray, you know, is arguably the best player in the country. So, you know, you go as far as him to some extent, but not, you know, one player can't do it all himself. So good to see some production there. You know, this is a team that's going to be so much better in April than they are in February because of the midfield. And, you know, I thought maybe the midfield would have been a little bit better immediately than they have been. You know, I just really like some of the young players that they have. And, you know, whether it's like Dewey Egan or Johnny Schwartz, you know, there's just a lot of guys that like can be elite midfielders at the Division I level. It does take time. You're adjusting. You know, they've had some injuries. I know Lance Tillman's another guy that needs to be really active and involved, and he got hurt in the fall. And, you know, I'm not sure if he's been 100% himself. Herbert was a guy that, you know, I think you saw him as his full potential against Brown this week, but I don't know if he's been 100% this whole time. So I think you're going to see a progressively better North Carolina team rebounding versus Brown was a good first step, but there's still some work to do. And, you know, we already talked to about Johns Hopkins at least a little bit, but, you know, Johns Hopkins is, it's funny. Like, I guess I didn't really put it together how tough their schedule is this year in terms of, you know, the Georgetown game being just 2 days after Towson game, which, you know, I thought Johns Hopkins was clearly the better team against Towson, but playing any team 2 days after that is difficult to do. And then playing against Loyola, another tough game. So this is just another line of tough challenges for Johns Hopkins. And then they got Virginia and Syracuse after that. And then Navy, which is the team that, you know, after that season opening loss, I think has kind of started to find its feet a little bit. So, you know, I think they need some more consistency from everyone on the offensive end. I think the defense is starting to come together. But, you know, I'd kind of put my money on North Carolina if I was a betting man on this one. But I think that both of these teams are clearly teams that are not the most perfect versions of themselves yet, but could be in April and May.
Yeah, I'd look to see a little more offensive punch from Hopkins when they get back. Brendan Grimes and Casey McDermott both missed the Loyola game. And when they're back in the lineup, it will certainly help the Blue Jays offense. All right, Matt, it's time for the give and go.
Oh, yeah.
And since Dixie's not here this week, we can talk about music, real music.
Not the stuff like
Hall & Oates that he likes. And
do you give him a hint of what the give and go is going to be each week? Or is he really going off the fly?
He really goes off the fly.
Okay.
So I figured I'd bring something that would be a little bit possibly in your wheelhouse if you're ready. And you do not know. So just so I have not mentioned this to Matt. I don't even think he knew that he was going to have to do this, but of course he has to do this. It's time for the give and go. Matt Kinnear, I want you to rank your top five all-time grunge rock bands. So bands from the grunge era. They don't have to be from Seattle, but from that late 80s, early 90s, that sound. I will give you my top five. I don't think there's any surprises. The first two were easy for me. The next three were a little bit more difficult. I've did a little research on this, what some of the national publications, don't look anything up. Don't be searching for bands. Oh, no. You got to do this off the top of your head.
Trust me, I got this one pretty locked in.
Okay. But I was surprised at some of the rankings and really disturbed by some of the rankings as well when, you know, going to some music websites and seeing how they ranked the top 20 and the top 100 bands, stuff like that. Most of them were like top 10 because there weren't that many grunge bands, but there's some that are just complete trash. And I was like, how did that make your top 10? Just get out of here with that. But here's mine.
Okay.
I don't think it's any surprise to you that Pearl Jam is the number one all-time creative band. They're the number one American rock band, arguably, of all time. And they're also our favorite. So that's my number one. Number two, Nirvana. A lot of people might put them number one, but they just didn't have the longevity. By 1994, Kurt Cobain was dead and the band was lost from scene. While they had it, they were like the Gale Sayers of rock and roll. They, you know, they had an incredible few seasons, Hall of Fame material, but the longevity of their career just isn't there. Number three, Alice in Chains.
Mm-hmm.
Love that combination of Lane Staley. Loved him. Number four, Soundgarden. And number five, Stone Temple Pilots.
Okay. Not a bad list. I like it. Obviously, number one is Pearl Jam. I think that's...
I mean, there's no other way to go.
Anyone who's ever listened... And I'm trying to, like, you know... I'm trying to figure out what my definition of grunge is for the purposes of this. Because there's one band that is not necessarily of the grunge era that I'm considering.
Who would that be?
Queens of the Stone Age.
Okay.
I'm going to count them, I think, for the purposes of this.
It's fine.
But my number two is Soundgarden. I was lucky enough to see Soundgarden when Chris Cornell was still alive. See them a few times. The loudest, and I went to actually yesterday, I went to see Tool live in D.C.
Really?
And I don't know if I'm getting old. I'm not counting them for this. I don't think they fit into the grunge category here. I don't know if I'm just getting old or if they are just one of the loudest bands ever. But my ears have been hurting for a good day and a half since that show now. So wear ear protection, kids, because like I definitely should have had my earplugs there because I was hurting. Like my head was just like the next day, just pounding. But Soundgarden's my number two. I mean, I love everything Chris Cornell. Well, not everything. He had one really stinker album, but most everything that he was a part of. There are times, as much as I love Pearl Jam, where I think Soundgarden hits me like almost at the same level. Huge Soundgarden fan. I think Bad Motorfinger is up there. It's better than some of the Pearl Jam records. So
Soundgarden. You say that like I would be offended.
Yeah,
I just don't want to hurt your feelings. But no, you can say whatever you like here, Matt. This is your opinion.
Going from there, Queens of the Stone Age is the band, like I said, that, you know, I have at number three. They're a different sound, you know. Josh Holm is the voice, I guess, of them, and they kind of get that like mix of grunge and, you know, kind of a little bit of a Black Sabbath kind of thing going, and some weird electronic stuff in there. They at least, I think, fit the grunge mold of, like, you know, mentality. So I'm gonna include them. You know, they were formed out of an early grunge band, so that kind of counts. I like Mudhoney a lot, so they're gonna be my number four, and this is where it gets really, really tough in terms of like who I'm leaving out, so to speak, because I feel weird leaving out Nirvana, because I love Nirvana, but then Alice in Chains is right there too, and. I mean, I kind of want to do a tie.
I surveyed an expert, and he included Smashing Pumpkins as his number five.
Yeah.
Which I don't really consider, they're certainly of that era, but I wouldn't consider them grunge like the other ones. But yeah.
The other one I'm considering is Screaming Trees, who, yeah. You know, RIP Mark Lanegan, who just passed away this week. Another one of those voices.
This week?
Yeah, just the other day. Another one of those voices of that generation gone. And he actually was with Queens of the Stone Age for a few of their albums as kind of their secondary singer. You know, they have at least two, but I would say three great albums.
What's their big song? I Nearly Lost You, or Lost Nearly You. Lost You
was the one that was on the single soundtrack.
Yeah.
That, you know, kind of was their minor hit there. But I don't know. I think I'll go with Nirvana over Alice in Chains.
This is big. If Nirvana didn't make your top five, this would be a big, I mean, this would be breaking news.
Mostly because I think In Utero is a better top album than Alice in Chains' top album of Facelift.
I was looking.
Almost a push on their Unplugged, though. As much as people talk about the Nirvana Unplugged, the Alice in Chains Unplugged is just as good.
I went through some online research just seeing what other people sort of said. And there is one website called spindiddy.com that I never heard of, but they ranked them. And Pearl Jam is not in the top 10 grunge bands. They have them at number 14 on a list that goes to like 100. It's like, are you kidding me? I can't take you seriously. You have a band called, they have a band, number 13 is a band called Love Battery, which I've never heard of. And number 8 is Tad, and 10 is Skinyard. I don't know. I've never heard of those. And Blood Circus. I'm sure these are all legit bands, but I've never heard of them. You can't be in my top. You can't.
Well, you know who was in Skinyard for at least one album?
Nope.
Matt Cameron.
Matt Cameron. He makes it. He's in two bands in my top five here.
Yeah. I mean, he's been drumming for like 60 years.
If you add in all of the albums that he's been on, like, and yeah, possibly.
Tad was one I considered, but they're very much like, I'll like them a lot for 6 months and then won't listen to them again for a while. So they don't have the regularity.
And I love talking about this person because I think he's amazing. You know, speaking of drummers, is Dave Grohl. Mm-hmm. And I think he's had one of the greatest careers. He's the Larry David of music. So he was the drummer in Nirvana, the unheralded drummer in Nirvana, like Larry David, creator of Seinfeld, an iconic television show. And then he reinvented himself after Seinfeld was over and became the star and leading man of his own project, Curb Your Enthusiasm. Dave Grohl did the same thing with Foo Fighters. He said, I know what you think, I'm just the drummer of Nirvana, but I'm actually frontman, singer, songwriter, and guitar player in the Foo Fighters, another Hall of Fame band. So what also a career this guy's had. And he's also seems to be one of the nicest guys. Like everybody calls up Dave Grohl when they have a project or a benefit and they need someone to play anything. He'll just, well, you need me to play the xylophone? I'm in. Where do you need me to be? When?
Played the cross in high school.
Yeah, there you go. Hall of Famer.
I forget which high school. Was his high school in Northern Virginia. Maybe that's an urban legend, but I believe he played I don't know position, but he played the cross.
Way to bring it on home, Matt Kinnear. All right, we'd like to thank our guest this week, Jacksonville head coach John Galloway. Thank you for your time. Best of luck to you and the Dolphins this season. If you like what you heard, please like us on your favorite podcast app, leave a review, tell a friend, and share the love. It's free. If you're interested in advertising on this podcast or any other at Inside Lacrosse, let us know. Send us a DM or send us an email. Very affordable. We reach a huge, what was it, almost a million people just on last Saturday alone on InsideLacrosse.com. All dedicated lacrosse fans follow Inside Lacrosse. We always love to hear from you, so give us a shout out on Twitter. Mark is at Dixon Lacrosse. I'm at simply at D_FLY at DFly. And Matt Kinnear is at
Matt Kinnear.
And remember, stay positive, test negative, and as always, enjoy the games.
It's Pearl Jam exit music.